The theme song for the sequel cast is written and performed by Mark with a C. The sequel cast is also a proud member of the Battleship Pretension podcast fleet. You can listen to the sequel cast streaming on the Stitcher app at stitcher.com. Get more episodes of the sequel cast from sequelcast.com. Enjoy the show.
Shut down the third world. They lose, you win. Shut down America. You lose, they win. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
So what are you going to do?
Disappear.
After the credits roll, there's always more to tell. Especially when the video sales are doing really well. From Shock Treatment to Jason X to Police Academy 6. This is Sequel Cast, and they are unsurpassed at following a franchise until the bitter end. This is Sequel Cast. And your host, the best that I informed you that the show will now begin.
Hello and welcome to the Sequel Cast. The Sequel Cast is a podcast looking at films in a franchise, one movie at a time. And this time we're finishing out a duology that was voted upon by the listeners. Yes, you, the listeners, voted on the John Carpenter Escape duology featuring Snake Plissken. And this time, Snake is back. We're talking about Escape from La. Oh, wait, no, it's Escape from L.A. I'm your host, Matt. With me is Thrasher.
We're going to record this podcast by Bangkok rules.
We're going to record the whole podcast sounding like Snake Plissken. Call me Plissken. Call me Snake.
Man,
don't call me.
Man, this takes me back. We haven't done a show like this since the Two Jakes.
And we're not going to. So, yeah.
good call.
This was, yeah, directed by John Carpenter. I almost said directed by Snake Plissken. This came out in 96. And despite having what at the time was a fairly meaty budget of $50 million, yes, the mid-90s were a different time as far as economics go, this, you know, didn't do that hot. I think by the time you do overseas gross, and it did pretty well on video, they did okay, but it was not like the smash hit. And like you said last week, Thrasher, the first was a cult film. I don't think the average person knew what Snake Plissken. If you said John Carpenter, people would know him for Halloween, perhaps Starman, the Jeff Bridges romantic film. Right? I mean,
well, thankfully, when this came out, everyone I know loved John Carpenter for reruns of Escape from New York and Big Trouble in Little China on cable. And I was a big fan of him from reruns of The Thing on cable, so myself and everyone I knew, we were all looking forward to this film.
Yeah, you know, I saw this one first before watching Escape from New York. And it's weird because we've talked about sequels a lot here in the Sequel Cast these past 5 years doing the show. We've done it since 2010. And what it's made me realize is, you know, sometimes people, what they want from a sequel is basically a remake with a few things changed. They want something familiar with a few twists, but not too different. But Escape from L.A. is about as literal as that, you know, safe sequel can be. But structurally, even though different things happen, it's basically a remake from Escape from New York. And even though it's a lot more an expensive film, it looks cheap. And that's because of mid-90s CG doesn't help this film at all.
Yeah, film was undergoing a transitional period at the time, and not all the kinks had been worked out. John Carpenter is a very old-school director who was working with new technology in this film, and I think if it had been filmed in a more old-fashioned way, in a way much more like the original Escape from New York, I think it would have been a much bolder.
And allegedly, the budget for this film was cut at the last minute, so they probably did stuff in CG they didn't intend to, like the helicopters.
Oh yeah,
or his little like squiggly, you know, like one person submarine or vehicle.
Oh, the submarine rod, yeah.
But before we get into that, did you first see this on TV?
No, first saw this in the theaters opening weekend.
Oh, okay. Was it a crowded theater?
Not particularly. Although, keeping in mind, the theater that we went to was the old, it was the back in this day, this is back in North Virginia, was the old Main Gate Theater, which was a theater on an army base. And so the only, generally speaking, the only people who would go there would be to that theater were high school kids and people who were on the naval base. But I think like lots of people were out on deployment at the time, so there was just nobody there.
Right. You know, I saw the trailer and was intrigued, as I mentioned last episode, but didn't know who the hell Snake Plissken was, so I rented this on video, and I watched them out of order, which I would not recommend doing. It's an interesting exercise, just because by the time you finish with Escape from New York, you're like, oh, that's a much better film than Escape from L.A., and I don't think that's a controversial stance to take. I don't think this movie is awful. If I thought Escape from New York was okay, Escape from L.A. kind of feels like it's low-budget, made-for-sci-fi channel TV pilot, executive produced by Roger Corman. Like, there's something fun. I think, actually, the acting in this film, in a lot of ways, is better than Escape from New York.
Well, you know what? The way I look at it, this movie, you know, Escape from New York is a big old slab of New York pizza. This is a big old slab of New York pizza, the best the next day, which somehow tastes good in a different way the next day.
So like cold pizza? This is like cold pizza is what you're saying, right?
I suppose hungover, so, yeah. Which,
you're kind of hungover. It's like 10:30 in the morning. And you see, gee, there's that slice of pepperoni pie there in the fridge.
Well, this is a movie you want when you are getting ready to recover from a hangover.
I can dig that. You know, the action in this film is a lot more vehicular focused than in the first one. I mean, yes, in the first one you had the taxi cab and stuff, but it was more gunfights, more fist fights. In this, you get like a surfboard sequence. You get a motorbike chase that's fairly exciting. You get a hang gliding sequence. It's like extreme sports, Snake Plissken.
Yeah, there was a lot of that, and even to this day, I'm still not sure if that's there just because they wanted some spectacle or if that was there because extreme sports were going through a cycle of being big and they thought, oh, the kids will like it. Put some hang gliding in your movies.
I mean, it does feel very 90s, even though John Carpenter is an older man, right? By the time he's directing this film, I think he's in his 50s or something. I probably got that wrong, but I don't think I'm that far off. It feels so 90s. I think of, you know, in the beginning of the film, I believe Snake Plissken is wearing his original costume from the first film, which is, or if not, they just treated it really well, where it's all beat up and all this stuff. And then they give him a new outfit that has flame retardant and all this stuff, and it's like all slick black leather.
It has a badass trench coat attachment.
Yeah, not to mention this was in 96. This was before The Matrix, but maybe The Matrix guys got some ideas from Escape from L.A.
Well, I mean, black trench coats, they were huge in the 90s. I'm not entirely sure why, but this whole cyberpunk black trench coat look was a big thing.
Do you think it's from Silent Bob from the movie Clerks?
No, I don't think it's that. I think there was just it just kind of taps into that cyberpunk cynicism that was starting to dominate the age.
Yeah,
And goth culture. A lot of it was connected to goth
culture. Yeah, absolutely. Goth culture, of course. How can I forget? Stacy Keach, I think, is great in this film. As kind of the bad guy. He's sort of like narrating. I mean, what do you think of the setup of this film compared to the first one? I think they don't have the budget to pull off the scope that they want to go for, because it's a bigger scale of the scenario.
Well, the setup, it's so funny because like it is the same movie over again, and yet it's so complicated the way, it's almost gleefully complicated the way the movie starts, is that there's a new president who has a lifetime term, whose daughter is seduced by a South American revolutionary by means of a virtual reality network, who steals the control circuit for a doomsday weapon and then goes to a secret compound in Los Angeles, which is now the new mega prison because it got an earthquake, sent it off into the ocean. There is so much exposition behind this movie.
Yeah, way too much in the beginning.
It's almost like farce. It's almost a parody of expository science fiction.
And it was inspired by the there was a big earthquake in L.A. in the early 90s. in which the city kind of went topsy-turvy. Was it like 8 on the Richter scale? No, but it was bigger than what they usually get in L.A.
It was a big quake.
Yeah. It was a big quake, and you know that sort of inspired. Well, gee, and also you think of when you think of cities in the United States, the first two you're going to think of are New York and L.A. Probably.
Boston. I would go with Boston.
You go Boston or Chicago? Yeah, maybe. But yeah, I don't think Atlanta would even make the top five, or New Orleans might be another one. Escape from New Orleans. I think that'd be a more interesting setting than L.A. I mean, the tricky thing is like New York. It's like a walking city, right? You can walk all around and find all these fun pockets and alleyways. In L.A., you got to drive a shitload to get anywhere.
Well, it's,
but the weather's nice.
It's that old cliche, nobody walks in L.A.
That's right. That's exactly right.
There's also a song like that.
Walking in L.A. Right. Yeah, well, let's actually talk about this damn movie.
Okay.
So the setup is way too long. I think in Escape from New York, when the lighting is a lot more moody and mysterious, but here it's a lot of literal news person blabbing around. I mean, I think the CG in Escape from L.A. is worse than what we see in the intro cinematic to the computer game Command and Conquer. But it's similar kind of stuff with buildings exploding and showing these sort of effects of modern society, and you're trying to get a setting here, but yet again, you know, but the mission this time isn't to save the president, it's to save the president's daughter, and it's a different president this time around. And they screw Snake over yet again.
As always.
Or so it seems. And I wish they would have done that. You know, they make it really obvious with the close-up of him getting nicked by the chick there. Mm. And then they even flash back to it in case he didn't get it.
Yeah, and that is always a sign of a flawed movie when a movie shows you clips of itself.
Clips that you just would have seen 5 minutes ago. Like, hey, I don't think people got it. We have 3 close-ups of the nick on his hand.
Well, you know, I wonder if that just comes down to genre literacy, because that is a frequent staple in a lot of cyberpunk is a person, you know, getting infected with a disease or having like a bomb implanted in them, having to get a job done in order to get a problem that they've already been given fixed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of The Running Man, not the Schwarzenegger movie, but the original novella by Richard Bachman, better known as Stephen King. And the whole impetus for him doing the game thing is his, I think his daughter is about to die of some illness, and he needs to get money to buy her medicine within a certain amount of time. Which is very different from the setup of The Running Man, right?
Right.
But it's still like it's a literal ticking clock. I mean, as they say in any screenwriting course worth its salt, or any writing course really about structure, classic structure, is if you load the gun in Act 1, you're going to shoot it in Act 3. Set up, payoff. That's what it's about. And that gives a literal momentum to the plot. Again, Snake is such a... what do you say, narcissistic? I don't know. He's such a selfish character that he wouldn't do something unless he's, like, forced into it. He has no impetus to save these guys. He's been on the run since the events in Escape from New York.
Well, he owes no loyalty to any of these characters, so the only way they can get him to do something is to force him. They couldn't pay him to do a favor.
Right, and it has to be said, Kurt Russell kept himself in great shape for Escape from L.A.
Yeah, it's like he hasn't aged.
He looks slightly heftier, which is to be expected with age, but no, he's been in shape. I don't think the voice is quite as good as the first film, but I think part of that is as you age, your voice changes.
Could be.
It's a bit deeper. It's not that it was high-pitched in the first one, but it's a bit more growly, which is nice to see. But yeah, Stacy Keach is just a formidable presence kind of over the intercom. Kind of talking Snake through his mission. I love the actor they have as the president, Cliff Robertson.
Who, didn't he play JFK?
Not only did he play JFK, he played Uncle Ben in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man trilogy.
Oh, that's right.
He was a young JFK in the classic 1963 film PT-109 about JFK's service in the Navy?
The Pacific Theater, World War II.
Pacific Theater, World War II, right. But he gives like a real strong, intense performance that's kind of the opposite of what we got from George C. Scott in Escape from New York. That was a little bit more...
Was that
reserved?
Was that George C. Scott?
No, it was not George C. Scott.
I thought that was like Donald Pleasance.
It was Donald Pleasance. I was thinking of another jowly, bald actor.
Although George C. Scott would have made a marvelous. But yeah, well, this is yeah. Well, that's actually one thing I do like about the president in Escape from L.A. He is, in a lot of ways, archetypally American, as opposed to Donald Pleasance, who is British.
Yes, and I mean they're. They're definitely going for satire, doing some low blows to the Republican Party, which is obvious, I think, with what they're doing here. And
yeah,
John Carpenter's made his politics no secret in his films.
Yeah, this had to have been written during the height of the whole Contract with America thing.
Actually, an early draft was written in 85, and... then, like, it was rewritten and kind of a new concept was come up after the earthquakes in L.A. And it's interesting. The script is not only written by John Carpenter, but also by the producer Deborah Hill and Kurt Russell himself. I mean, the big reason this film got made is because Kurt Russell really wanted to play Snake again. John Carpenter was kind of take it or leave it. But Kurt Russell is the guy that really willed this into production. And I'm sure he kicked in some of his salary towards the budget and all this stuff to help with the production. So, and he does a great job with the character. I forgot a young Steve Buscemi is in this film.
Has Steve Buscemi ever truly been young? I feel like he's an ageless ghoul, and I mean that in the most respectful way.
He's good at playing kind of like a slimy scumbag, but it's not like he comes off, he's still kind of like lovable at the same time. Like, this character is... ultimately out for himself, but he's playing all the sides against each other. He knows a lot more than you would think by his facade of, oh, I do maps to the Hollywood stars. Peter Fonda is bizarre in this film. Is there anything you like about this movie?
Well, I guess when it comes down to it, I like Snake. I honestly don't care what is happening around him in the rest of this movie, but Kurt Russell as Snake Plissken, I still love seeing on screen.
Yeah, the best sequence to me is there's a bit of a chase sequence where, you know, it's been revealed in the very extensive mission briefing at the beginning that Snake has to rescue the president's daughter, and she apparently is hooked up with this sort of, like, revolutionary kind of... You know, it seems like a Central American dictator kind of figure with the way he dresses, like a Che or something. And Snake is catching up to him on a motorcycle and kind of punching these guys left and right. And then in the middle of this action scene, the head guy that Snake's going to just try and assassinate throws a bolo that wraps around his neck and knocks him off the motorbike. And that whole kind of action sequence, I think, is a lot of fun. And has a few surprising twists in there, and that, you know, this mission isn't going to be over as quick as Snake wants it to be, because he just wants to get the hell out of there. He wants to get the job done, or maybe find some way to conquer this disease and just live his life.
You know, one thing I actually kind of do like, because, you know, you always have to have Snake hook back up with an old partner in crime, and in this one, you know, the partner in crime he's looking for is a guy called Carjack Malone, who has at this point become a transgendered gang leader named Hershey La Palma. And I like that there is a credible transgender character in this movie.
Played by Pam Grier.
Yep.
That is nice. I think... I wish the voice could have been... I don't know, like a bit less cartoonish.
True, and I suppose they could have actually found like a transsexual actor to play it, or if all
right,
else fails,
right.
Just go for RuPaul, because RuPaul was huge at this time.
Yeah, you know, I actually, when I rewatched the movie, I thought RuPaul was in it. I forgot it was Pam Grier, but I remembered there's a transgendered African-American character. Bruce Campbell was great and pretty much unrecognizable as, and I wish the whole movie could have been about this character instead, the Surgeon General of Beverly Hills.
Yeah, harvesting organs and things like that.
Right, and he looks at Snake's one eye. He's like, it looks good. Pity you just have one. And he takes out this sharp, nasty instrument. He's just going to go right for it. No numbing gel, no drugs. No, he's just going to chop that right out. And I thought, you know, had they gone through with it, that could have been interesting. You would have had a blind Snake.
Well, you know what's so funny is that they put Bruce Campbell in all this makeup to make him look like he's had a horrendous number of plastic surgeries, and yet he comes out looking like Robert Zadar.
It doesn't look that horrendous compared to, you know, some of the mistakes of the nurses that help him that have the really droopy cheeks and the lips. It also reminds me a bit of another film we've talked about quite some time ago in the sequel cast, Star Trek Insurrection, where you have the whole subplot of the, I don't recall what the aliens are called, that do the facelifts constantly.
Oh, yeah, we'll just call them the evil aliens.
Yeah, the guy that was a bad guy in Amadeus played the head guy. It's going to bother me now. But, you know, they're going for the same sort of satire vibe and how much everyone gets plastic surgeons. And, I mean, I was talking to a co-worker a few days ago, actually, who grew up in L.A. and said in his high school, so many girls, the minute they turned 16, got nose jobs. I knew people that got nose jobs as well when they turned, or girls that got nose jobs as well as soon as they turned 16. And, you know, I guess it's your money. You can do what you want with it. But unless it's like reconstructive stuff after a traumatic cancer or injury, plastic surgery just isn't my thing. I don't know. But, you know, that's an individual's choice, I guess, is my getting off the soapbox here. And it's a fun kind of wicked little scene. I wish the movie would have had more time in that world instead of you get like sequences in the sewer and I don't know, like the scenarios that Snake finds himself in are not as compelling or dangerous as Escape from New York.
Well, they also don't necessarily have the same, you know, amount of atmosphere. There was a lot more atmosphere in Escape from New York and just like interesting things such as like the live stage show and that chilling moment with the sewer cannibals. No one seems at all that threatening in LA, and I almost wonder, since they do set up that most of the prisoners in the Los Angeles jail are, for all intents and purposes, political prisoners, is the implication because they're political prisoners who were put there by a conservative regime, does that mean they're all liberals and so they don't have that much to fight over and so things are generally orderly? Or did they just not think to put in enough incident? Because with the New York prison shut down, they would have been sending all the hyper-violent criminals there as well.
Maybe if it would have started with Snake Plissken getting arrested and he has to escape from prison, I don't know. Like, there's certain things that I think have some atmosphere as Snake is approaching what is now the island of L.A. You see underwater, like, sharks floating in Universal Studios and all this other stuff, which is kind of neat. And there's a scene later on in the film where he's wandering on the highway with burned out cars and fires everywhere.
Well, actually, wasn't that maybe I'm misremembering, but wasn't that actually a joke that one of the sharks you see when he's in the submarine is actually the animatronic shark from the Jaws ride at Universal Studios?
I think so, because it happens right after he goes past the Universal Studios logo.
Yeah, and then of course, there's a couple of things that they could have taken further, like the Cuervo having his like base is effectively Disneyland, but I don't think they ever identify it as Disneyland.
Sure, I mean, you do have to get the rights for that at this point when this film was made in the 90s. But yeah, quite interesting with some of the imagery here. A lot of it's kind of take it or leave it. And I don't think, even though, you know, trying to rescue the president's daughter is a lot less interesting than trying to rescue the president.
Yeah, but she's not as much of a character.
No. And it's funny that she kind of has revolutionary politics but dresses in pink in one of the briefing videos they watch in the beginning to kind of fill you in on the story. I think they make that overly complicated. They could have gone with something a lot simpler. I'm also kind of surprised that I wish they could have saved it for later, that part of the plot twist is that they want him to kill the president's daughter. Because they kind of let that out of the bag pretty early.
Well, I mean, they make it clear the president considers her a traitor and is going to have her executed.
Right, but the important thing is less the daughter than to get that black, get the black box.
Yes, for the Damocles system.
And that is one thing about the film I think works well, is the ending. It's more of a fuck you ending than what we got from Escape from New York.
Well, it's an ending that you can't go back from. It's, you know, it would make it difficult to do a third movie that is the first movie over again. Where we get the classic switcheroo where they think they get the control circuit back and the president activates it and instead hears one of Map to the Stars Eddie's pre-recorded spiels, and I love the music. I love L.A.
Yeah.
And then Snake's got the real Damocles, and the Damocles, they're these satellites that can project EMPs, and the idea is you angle them over a country, and you can take down their entire electronic infrastructure. And then what Plissken does is he activates the Armageddon protocol. The entire Earth gets hit with a massive EMP. And suddenly, we are in a pre-industrial age.
Not only that, there's switcheroos on top of switcheroos at the end. It's revealed the fatal disease Snake is injected with is not fatal at all. It's merely a mild strain, like a strain
of the flu.
It's like
the cold. It's just
a cold, yeah.
Which I like. I actually like that. I like that it's not a real like thing, that they just lied to him.
And it even comes up earlier in the film, but then Steve Buscemi cuts him off with, no, it's real. I know it's real. I've talked to the scientist that made it. Because Pam Grier at one point says it's fake. Mm. So if you pay attention, you would have caught that earlier. And also, there's the plot twist of Snake being a hologram.
Oh, yeah.
When he gives his speech. Because they set up the holograms at the beginning, as I said, set up and payoff.
Yeah, all the pipe is there.
All the pipe is there. It's just kind of laid and I was kind of bored watching this film, but at the same time, you can't help but have fun with how ludicrous a lot of it is. The score by John Carpenter and Shirley Walker is more like guitar-based than synth, which was in line with what John Carpenter was doing at the time. I mean, in the opening credits, you get a more guitar-driven version of the theme from the first film. And it's not bad, but it's not as spooky as the original.
True. I guess what I'm looking for is, you know, everything's a little bit too sharp. I kind of want that rough stock look from the first movie. That's just so much. Like, I feel like that's the what the world looks like through Snake Plissken's eyes. That's what I want to see. Or his eye.
I almost wonder if that's because this was made in the 90s. I think of 90s movies, and I think of everything looking too clean, too supermodel looking. Everything looks too perfect. And in the 80s, you had a lot of grit and a lot of like moody red and blue lighting, a lot of grain in the film. When Escape from L.A. is like, you know, if Escape from New York is like you're walking on the beach and you find a beat-up shark tooth buried in the sand with little chips out of it and has some character to it, Escape from L.A. is like a plastic shark tooth replica you get at the gift store in the hotel. It's trying to go for the same thing, but it's... It looks just a little bit too nice
Well, you know, speaking of going for the same thing, do you know that, were you aware that Shecky Spielberg made his own version of Escape from L.A.?
Yeah, I actually hear him calling in. Let's patch him in.
Hey, Shecky.
Hey, how you doing?
No, Shecky,
you're talking about a film, Escape from La La, right?
Actually, no. I was talking about the porno version you did, a Sexscape from L.A. But tell me about the Spanish language one you did.
Well, the Spanish one was just the porn dubbed in Spanish. Unfortunately, I did not know any Spanish, so I just said "Hola, hola, hola" over and over again. Quite the voice track. It won an award at the Spanish Pornies.
So
My Little Pony is the Spanish award show for that sort of film.
You dubbed all the voices yourself?
Yeah, and I didn't know Spanish, so I just said, hola, hola, hola. That's one of my more memorable takes.
That is
But let's talk about the English language version. What was it called again? My memory ain't what it used to be.
Sexscape from L.A.
There you go, Sexscape from L.A. So in this one, it's a guy, Snake Plissken.
Really? Not Snake Foreskin?
Not Snake Foreskin. That comes later. You ruin the plot. Damn it. Snake Plissken finds out there's a porno convention around the corner from his apartment. And when he locks himself in the bathroom. Meanwhile, there's an orgy happening in the stall next door. He wants to join the orgy, but he can't. So he has to make a sescape to get laid. We said L.A. because it sounded more fancy. And I had my kid brother, Georgie Lucas Boyg, play on the piano, the music, as you see Snake Plissken, who changed his name to the porno name Snake Foreskin. He dumps Georgie Lucas Boyg, plays on his piano, as we have 90 minutes of close-up of Snake Foreskin sweating, trying to get out of the bathroom stall to join the orgy next door. Before everyone is too tired and has taken a snooze, I mean. So the music that George Lucas Boyg played was on a Tinkertoy Casio piano, and it sounded like ding, 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 ding. It sounded sort of like John Carpenter, but out of tune and half the tempo.
No, and that's really what's fascinating, because he does, in real time, takes 90 minutes for him to escape from his bathroom into the bathroom where they're having the orgy. So this is
unique
among pornos as being the one that has the least ratio of sex scenes to running time of any porno ever made.
Yeah, and in fact, I could not get a lady to come in the studio to dub all the sexy noises that Snake is hearing. So instead, I got my pet parrot, Juju, and Juju the parrot said, ow, ow. And I dubbed that in and pitched it up a little bit to sound like a lady. I don't know if it fooled anyone, but we got a Spanish dub. We released the English and the Spanish one at the same time.
Now, why didn't you just use the parrot sounds for the Spanish dub?
Well, I think the parrot lacked some Latin flair. The parrot came from New Jersey, so I decided to do it myself. I'm an auteur. Wait, what's that? I'm being told this film was only screened once at the Porno Festival, and George Lucas Boyg had all copies destroyed.
Now, why would he do that? Why would he disparage your legacy like that?
Because he knows that he made an earlier production with me, the Spoy Moy's Holiday Special, and it was so embarrassing, he couldn't do anything with it.
Oh, that's right, with Art Carney and B. Arthur.
I call it a double B. Arthur, but yeah. So, okay, well, I got to get going. I'm running late. I got to, how do the kids say these days? Drop a deuce.
Is that your upcoming film?
No, but if Kevin James makes something, Mall Cop 3, maybe we'll do something. Mall Cop Deuce Edition.
Fantastic. It was great talking with you, Shecky.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Shecky
Spielberg. Spielberg, of course. Well, we have one listener that'll like that segment. I don't know if anyone else likes it.
Is that listener Shecky Spielberg?
The world may never know. Escape from L.A., out of 5 stars, I'd give this 2.5. Like, John Carpenter's done worse. He's done better. They could have tried a bit more, or I would love to see a special edition of this with better special effects. I rarely say that, but this film could use it. I don't think it would save the film either. That's the problem, though. And maybe there's a lot of scenes cut out of this, because this runs a pretty lean 101 minutes.
Yeah, I guess I'll give it 3, which is really rare for me, because Carpenter is one of those figures where any movie you see of his, I find that people either absolutely love it or absolutely hate it. This may be the only true middle ground movie he's ever done. And I don't think it's bad. I don't think my time or money was wasted seeing this movie. I still enjoyed it, but I mainly enjoyed Snake Plissken.
Yeah, there's something about that character that just works.
It's a good movie. It is the only good Carpenter movie. Everything else is great or terrible.
Yeah, the 90s weren't kind to Carpenter's output, but that's another story. So...
Oh, there's actually something that we touched on last week I thought we might want to touch on here, which were the trailers for this movie.
Okay, we got to pick up the pace, though. We have another show scheduled to record in half an hour.
Oh, yeah.
So why don't you... Can you pocket that?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
For later? Okay. So, because we're running low on time, pitch a sequel. I guess what I would do is Escape from New Orleans. I would have it be like... It happens during Hurricane, some future version of Hurricane Katrina. So you have a town that's mostly water, but little like bits of buildings popping up over the surface. It'd be more darker in tone to the first film, and there'd be a scene where, for no reason, Kurt Russell has to eat a muffaletta sandwich to survive. it'd be called Escape from... Instead of New Orleans, it'd be Escape from N.O. What's your pitch of sequel?
Mine is going to be Escape to New York. So the movie's going to take place a month or two after the events of Escape from L.A., still in the future of, like, 2001. And the whole deal is, now that the whole world has been reduced to this pre-industrial level of technology and effectively anarchy, there's, ironically enough, only one bastion of civilization left, and that is the island of Manhattan. That is the New York prison. Simply because it's stocked with people who already have over a decade of experience surviving in a pre-industrial society, working with refurbished technology. So it's all about Snake fighting his way there and eventually carving out his own life and fighting his way to the top of this burgeoning island nation of Manhattan with its steam-powered cars and chandelier lights.
What would it be called?
Escape to New York.
That's right, you said that, I'm sorry. Okay,
it's a fortress city.
Yeah, let's move on to sequel news really quick. One thing I noticed, and this is such like rumor stage, I almost hesitate, but you know that people do a news story about a tweet, right? All the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm actually going to write an article. Oh, no, wait, Variety confirmed it. Shit, really? This is weird. So remember when we did Alien not too long ago, Neil Blomkamp, director of films like District 9 and the upcoming Chappie, posted all these concept pictures of an Alien film he wants to do?
Yes.
Apparently, 20th Century Fox has signed Blomkamp to do a new Alien movie. So whether it means we'll get to see come to life some of those concept sketches, such as Sigourney Weaver's head in an alien on top of an alien body... And a rejiggered version of Newt. I have no idea. I think Neil Blomkamp's a good director. I have not seen his... I love District 9, have not seen Elysium or the new movie Chappie yet. And I don't know if we need to continue Ripley's saga. I think Alien Resurrection just sort of killed it with its ending. And Prometheus was already something kind of new in that same universe. I'm not sure we need this. But I think Blomkamp is a really talented guy, and if you're going to do it, he's not a bad choice.
I think once again we'll get a very different kind of Aliens movie. It might wash some of the taste of the Aliens versus Predators out of our collective mouths.
Alien versus Predator versus Alien 5. I don't know. Any other piece of sequel news jumps out to you?
Just that there's a Nicolas Cage movie coming out called The Trust. And there's a couple of other people who are going to be in it too, but it's just been confirmed that Jerry Lewis is going to be playing Nicolas Cage's father in that movie.
Nicolas Cage's father?
Yep.
Wow. He hasn't acted in something officially in a long time. He did sort of an indie film that was a drama not too long ago.
Yeah, I mean, this is fascinating, and I almost wonder, is this going to be another crazy Nicolas Cage freakout movie? And if so, are they going to give Jerry Lewis an equal freakout? You know, or is it going to be, what's going on, man? Huh? What's going on, man? Versus, well, hey, why don't you calm down?
Right. That'd be an interesting pairing. We'll have to see. Jerry Lewis has been in really bad health for quite some time. So we're curious to see what comes of it. Nicolas Cage lately has made some very interesting choices and some very boring choices, but at least he's done some interesting stuff as opposed to Johnny Depp, who somehow got more boring. Despite the fact that he at one point seemed to be like Nicolas Cage and then he tried really hard. I mean, that Community episode, I believe the line was Johnny Depp, the bad kind of good, and Nicolas Cage, the good kind of bad. I have that backwards, don't I?
No. It was in reference to Nicolas Cage. Is he the bad kind of good like Johnny Depp, or the good kind of bad like... It wasn't Bruce Campbell, it was a weird actor that they had as the good kind of bad. It's a great line.
Right. Though. Sure, absolutely. Let's move on to whatcha watching.
Oh, man. So, over this past weekend, I ended up getting caught up on Starship Troopers and saw all three. Yes, there are now three Starship Troopers sequels.
I've seen those as well, not recently. But what did you think? I actually know the guy that wrote the CG one, which I have not seen all the way through yet.
The CG one... It's strange, and this might simply be because it was CG, but the more I watched the CG one, the more it became my favorite out of all the sequels. It was competent, it told a coherent story, it put an interesting twist on the cinematic Starship Troopers universe. Brilliant design work. It also very much reminded me of Harlock, which I talked about in an earlier episode. Where it's that same kind of very technical sort of Japanese style of CGI animation.
Years ago, I saw half of the Japanese OVA of Starship Troopers, which is just bizarre.
I really want to see that.
Awful. Awful J-pop sequences throughout. Has next to nothing to do with the book. Came out after the book, of course, but way before the movie. So I really have a soft spot for Starship Troopers 3, Marauder.
It is fun. I mean, that one really captures the satirical edge of the first movie.
Love the song and dance number. I'm not even making that up.
It's a good day to die.
When you know the reason why, citizens, we fight for what is right. That's right. A noble sacrifice. Okay, I'll stop because we're running out of time. But that was good. I liked it. I think... But Starship Troopers 2, I just hate. It's just bad. It's like... they were ashamed to make a Starship Troopers movie. It's like a remake of 10 Little Indians.
Yeah, it's almost as if they had a different script and had to retroactively plug in Starship Troopers signifiers to it.
Right, yeah, I agree with that.
But it's just more fodder if we ever do Starship Troopers as a series.
Did you think the first film held up okay?
Actually, yes. I find that it still does. It's regrettably it's in that glorious position where the older and that movie gets, the more up to date it is.
I do think it's one of those films that it makes me wish Verhoeven to do a big budget American picture again. He has a new movie coming out, but it's another sort of smaller European drama, kind of like what he started his career with. But man, that he followed up Starship Troopers with the Invisible Man movie with Kevin Bacon.
Oh, yeah.
Which was bad.
Hollow Man?
Hollow Man, God. Such a disappointing follow-up. And Starship Troopers, the movie, lost a lot of money, but it was like one of the biggest sellers ever on home video.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why it got those sequels.
And it was all over cable.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the trailers for Starship Troopers used that pop song. Woohoo!
Oh, yeah. Song 2 by Blur.
Yeah. Which, I guess it's fitting. I don't know. Like, Starship Troopers is kind of dude bro.
And it inspired a tabletop miniatures war game that I believe is still in print to this day.
Hmm.
And of course, Roughnecks, the animated series.
I like some of that, even though the CG is just awful by any standards.
Well, to be fair, almost all television CG was awful back then.
And then, yeah, sure. I mean, it was an expensive show at the time for Sony to produce. I got to see... I've been watching a bit more of the show Gotham. I'm not completely caught up yet, but I watched some of the second half of the first season. And I'm sort of mixed on the show. You know, for a while, they were going with this storyline at Arkham Asylum, where they station... why can't I think of his name? I'm just an idiot.
Gordon,
thank you, to Arkham Asylum. And I thought if they really like stayed with that, that would have been pretty cool. Where he's on his own with a bunch of lunatics and this kind of early version of this asylum that's made famous in some of the graphic novels and the video games. And they kind of wrapped up that story pretty quick. And then the Penguin stuff, I think, by far is the best stuff in Gotham.
Yeah, the Penguin storyline is amazing. Bullock is a phenomenal character. I love Alfred. Yeah. Not crazy about Bruce Wayne, but I love Alfred as a character.
Alfred is great. Anytime you can get him in action scenes is pretty funny. But yeah, the stuff with young Bruce Wayne and young Catwoman and young Poison Ivy, and you have a bit of young Scarecrow, I think, in one of these episodes.
Yes, he gets a two-parter.
Yeah, that's the most recent stuff I've seen. I haven't seen... I saw a promo that the Joker is kind of teased in that, in one of those. I've seen that one.
I've seen that one. Very interesting.
Do they make it, like, good? I mean, that's such a loaded thing to do.
It's what they're trying to do in that episode is an Agatha Christie Poirot mystery.
Huh. Okay.
It doesn't quite work. You will probably see every turn and reveal coming.
Yeah.
That being said, it's a very competently made episode.
Does the guy do a scary Joker laugh?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he does.
It's not dubbed by Mark Hamill, is it?
No, although that would be interesting.
They did that for a sequence of that show Birds of Prey from the
90s. Wasn't that in the pilot?
Hmm?
Wasn't that in the pilot?
It was in the pilot. Did a flashback of Batman fighting the Joker, had stuntmen playing both, but had Mark Hamill, at least, dubbed over the voice of the Joker. And these sort of moodily lit sequences, which is pretty neat. Okay, well, let's move on to the Paul Goebel Memorial mashup.
All right. In the interest of saving time, I'm not going to explain it. I'm just going to jump right in. What I got, I got a brand new soda. What I got, I want to make it carbonated. What I want to give it to you. Drink it all up and you feel really great. I know it's true. This soda is made with the extract of prunes. I know it's free.
Got it.
What do you got?
Red Hot Dr. Peppers.
Yes!
I got one. Even a loser wins sometimes.
You got me before I got to the line about it's a soda with a PhD.
Yeah, you know, so what? I could tell Red Hot Chili Peppers right away. And then when you start singing about soda, I'm initially thinking of the fizzy lifting drinks from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And I'm trying to think, what pun can you make with Red Hot Chili Peppers and Willy Wonka? And I'm also thinking, is the name of some of the band members in Red Hot Chili Peppers, could that be turned into a Willy Wonka pun? And then I heard you mention Pepper, and I'm like, aha, Dr. Pepper, Chili Pepper, Red Hot Dr. Pepper.
Although, now that I think about it, we could do Mike T. Flea, combining Mike TV from Willy Wonka with Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh, maybe for the next week's.
that's a little preview.
Okay, so...
Boing.
Boing. So to wrap this up, Thrasher, it's your turn to pick out what series we do next.
Oh, gosh, really?
Yeah. This was a rare twofer franchise.
Well, you know what? Just to give you an excuse to get this finished off, and because we need some payback for one of our famous Lost episodes, let's do Starship Troopers.
Nice. So what films are we going to cover?
Be Starship Troopers, Starship Troopers 2, Hero of the Federation, Starship Troopers 3, I forget what that one's called, and Starship Troopers 4, the CGI one. And I guess we'll talk about... Although, could we do a special episode where we talk about Roughnecks and various other Starship Troopers spinoffs?
I'd rather not do a special episode, but we can mention that, you know, when we get to Starship Troopers 2, I guess, because that was sort of cool. In the lull. There's also been some video games over the years, but I've never played any of them. I knew one was an RTS. They had a few action games. So, yeah, we'll talk about that throughout the course of those episodes. Sounds good. We're going to do a month of Starship Troopers. So get your
It'll
favorite.
Be a good day to die.
Citizens, you fight for what is right. A noble sacrifice. When duty calls, you pay the price.
Something tells me that's the song that's going to play at the end of this episode, not anything from
I probably from should. LA. Yeah, in the movie, they don't play that number that much, but then, like, over the end credits, you see the whole thing, and it's a deleted scene, I think, on the DVD.
Hey, you can follow me on Twitter, at Internet Mayor.
You can follow me on Twitter, at SequelCast. If you're in the Portland, Oregon area, I do a pub quiz for Geeks Who Drink weekly, Tuesday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. at the Iconic Lounge. Be sure and come. It's free to play and fun to play. Theme song again, Mark with a C. Check out his website, markwithac.com. We're part of the Battleship Pretension podcast fleet. Check that out, battleshippretension.com. any conventions coming up, Thrasher?
Not in the near future, but I will be at Comic Palooza down in Texas. So definitely check that out. Go to comicpalooza.com, I believe is their website. Then of course Origins and Gen Con are the two big ones that I'm building for now. Now I might be making some. Oh, and I will be at the Lexington Comic and Toy Show. Have not finalized what I'm going to be doing there, but you will be able to see me in person there. I'll probably be doing some panels.
Very cool. And again, best way to get in contact with us, go to facebook.com/sequelcast for the sequelcast. This is Matt.
This is Thrasher.
Saying,
nobody draws till this can hits the ground.
Uh-oh, that can had explosives. I probably shouldn't have shot it.
That scene is so badass, I wish they hadn't given it away in the trailer.
I can see why they did, though. If you tried a trailer that spelled out the entire premise of the movie... I mean, what if the movie would have started where California was still part of the United States, and then there's an earthquake while Snake is on it, and it's separated?
But then where's he going to go? He'd only be separated from the people he doesn't want to be with to begin with.
I just want to see a plot twist where Snake Plissken has like a child that also has long hair and an eye patch and smokes cigars. You're just a little snake in the grass like your papa. Good luck and good night. Oh, we didn't talk about the SNL 40th anniversary special.
No, we didn't.
Let's talk about that really quick, and then we're going to have like a 5-minute break.
Okay.
Did you see it?
Yes, I did.
I thought it would have had less clips. I was kind of surprised how much of a clip show it was. But the Celebrity Jeopardy and the sequence with all the brief music bits of the comedic music songs over the years that Martin Short and Maya Rudolph kind of emceed, I thought was pretty good. Those are my favorite moments.
Yeah, overall it was good. I mean, it was a lot. It was almost all fan service.
Eddie Murphy can go fuck himself. That's the biggest.
Yeah, Chris Rock plays this amazing tribute to Eddie Murphy, and then Murphy just kind of comes up, "Hi, I'm here. Let's do a show. Goodbye."
And then they don't cut to commercial right away because I'm sure the director of the show is like, "What the hell?"
Yeah, I feel like. Yeah, I almost wonder, was he supposed to do something he decided not to at the last minute? Like, I feel like everyone on the show seemed to really want to be there except Eddie Murphy.
And Eddie Murphy could have done the same speech and then throw in some zingers, like, you know, imitate James Brown or do the white person voice or do Buckwheat or Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood. He could have thrown a few references in there. You know, like several years ago, they came out with the book that was an oral history of Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah.
And Eddie Murphy is one of the only people that didn't participate. And the reason for that is he said, my work on the show just speaks for itself. And that was a great time in my life, and I love all it did. And there's something to be said for that, and that's probably what he was going for. But it's like he played the press up so much. He played them like a fiddle, I guess, right? So...
Yeah, the only real missed opportunity is that when Paul Simon sang Still Crazy after all these years, I really felt like Lorne Michaels should have come out in a chicken suit, or the whole cast, current cast, should have come out in chicken suits. I felt like that was a perfect opportunity for a callback.
Well, Lorne Michaels got choked up a bit at the end when they brought him on stage. And the running joke of Jad Lovitz while being a fuck you is still pretty funny.
Yeah, I love that. John Lovitz dead.
He's dead. Yeah.
And he cuts it in.
In the in memoriam too,
yeah. In memoriam,
cuts
that was
him in
great.
The audience. He's like, Piscopo, big surprise as Sinatra.
Yeah.
That was great. Nice to see.
That was the funny thing is I saw this with my wife and I found and like I had kept having to explain who people were.
Yeah, I mean they didn't use a lot of the new cast to be honest, which makes it's a 40th anniversary special. I didn't much like the montage about New York stuff, but I can see why it was in there.
Did like that Wayne's World bit about how the opening sequence you always have to catch someone in the act of enjoying New York nightlife and they do that perfect pantomime of everybody's SNL intro shot.
Or my favorite of the Wayne's World gags was like, yeah, they shouldn't do many characters with catchphrases and then proceed to say 6 Wayne's World catchphrases in succession. Swing. Yeah.
I'm talking about Kanye.
Excellent. Yeah, oh, the Kanye thing was good. Yeah, I mean, you know, seeing that, it makes me wonder. There's that bit, and then not too long ago on SNL, they did a bit with Mike Myers as Dr. Evil. Tying into the Sony hack, and it was kind of a joke with Korea and stuff. And I think I'd rather see a new Wayne's World than a new Austin Powers at this point.
Because
think about it. You take Wayne's World
about,
into the YouTube. No, Wayne's World is now a YouTube star, right?
That makes a kind of sense.
If you wanted to do a commentary on that sort of thing, and everyone has a smartphone, everyone can be their own. The Truman Show has truly come to life. Okay, well, we got to go and hop, take a piss and hop into our next show. So... again, okay. sequelcast.com. Next week, we're going to start covering Starship Troopers 1 through 3, and then the direct-to-video movie. That's a cartoon.
Do your part and download those episodes, citizens. Would you like to know more?
Starship Troopers has lots of bugs. No. It's too much like our college years.
I've got a story to tell you, actually, but we'll save that.
I'll save it. Put a pin in it. Good night.
When you know the reasons why, citizens, we fight for what is right.
The Sequel Cast is a Hipster Goblin production.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.